and ask God's blessing on our time together. May the Lord be with you.
With thy spirit.
Let us pray. Oh God, we give you thanks for the Anglican Way Institute, for the Church of the Holy Communion. We thank you for Bishop Michael's ministry to us this week. Thank you for this opportunity we have to gather in this workshop and discuss the implications of our faith on our civic duties, especially as it regards how we vote and what parties and platforms we support. We pray your blessings again this day on the city of Dallas, on its police force, on the DART police force, on the people who grieve this day. We pray for the souls of the lives that were lost. We pray that this day, as always, all that we think and do and say will be for the benefit of our fellow man and for the honor and glory of your name. These things we ask in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, what's the old saying? He who fails to learn from history is doomed to repeat it. So I'll try not to do that. I gave this talk yesterday, and I spent way too much time getting warmed up to my subject, and then I looked at the clock, and we were pretty much out of time for the actual practical part of it, which is the whole point of this, really. The whole point of this week for me has been to strengthen me and my faith, and I've got my worship folder with me here, so I'm going to read from its cover again. The church and the state, the Christian's responsibility in the public square. We've been touching on that in lots of different ways in the workshops. And of course, Bishop Michael's been doing a wonderful job presenting sort of the conceptual and historical framework for how we engage as the church with the state. And today I want to spend a little bit of time talking about specifically how that connects with our duties as voters. Let me say as well that the badge that we wear around and all the other artwork, you know, shows church, state, and puzzle pieces. And I'll have to say at the very beginning, I first voted in the year 1988. I was actually 20 years old at the time, but it just so happened that there wasn't a general presidential election, of course, in 1986. 1988 was my first time to vote. I've been a very involved that, yeah, I don't have a handout. I'm decidedly low-tech. Let me say real quick what I said to my group yesterday. I didn't want to bore you by showing you PowerPoint slides of typewritten, double-spaced, 12-point font text. I'm not real creative, so I don't have pictures and stuff. If you are interested in having your own copy of these notes, I'm happy to provide them to you. I don't have them printed out, but if you'll give me your email before you go, I'm happy to send a, it's just a Word document. So anyway, yesterday I spent way too much time talking about sort of background and everything, but I just want to real quickly tell you sort of who I am and where I come from and why I'm, number one, not really an expert on this topic. It's just, in one way, I'm sort of a beggar trying to show other beggars where to find bread, as the old saying goes. I was born in Austin, spent a little bit of time in Oklahoma, and mainly raised in Nashville, Tennessee, and my southern heritage meant that I was raised a Dallas Cowboys fan, even though we lived in Nashville and Texas seemed like a foreign country to me at the time. And I just sort of inherently knew that God was on the side of the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, you know, the whole picture, right? Especially the fact that Tom Landry, this devout Christian man who always was dressed impeccably and never wore a hat in a dome stadium and all that sort of thing. Right.
Did you ever let the hometown team of Titans?
Well, they weren't there when I, they weren't there when I was growing up, of course. Yeah, we had no professional sports. Well, at any rate, I never thought to ask, is there any other option? And just to, again, for the purpose of illustration, it was very simple in my childlike mind. Cowboys are good. Everybody else is bad, but especially the Steelers, right? Growing up in the 70s, the Steelers crushed us in the Super Bowl, and especially that heartbreaking 1979 Super Bowl where a call that wasn't made, and yeah, Jackie Smith dropping a ball that probably he could have caught 99 times out of 100. It was heartbreaking. Well, the same sort of thing was going on in my sort of political formation, right? I just sort of instinctively absorbed what was going on around me. I was first really politically aware in the early 1970s. I remember catching a fleeting glimpse of Richard Nixon, who I could not have picked out of a police lineup and frankly had no idea who he was because I was 6 years old, but he was resigning on television. My grandmother's crying. I'll just tell you real quickly, the Hampton side of the family had been Republican since at least the 20s. They just always instinctively supported the Republican candidate. I later learned that my grandmother on my mother's side of the family was a diehard yellow dog Democrat because she thought FDR hung the moon. And as I start to grow, though, and learn more about politics, and I won't bore you with all the stuff I bored yesterday's group with, you know, I grew up in the days of Jimmy Carter and the gas lines and the Iran-Contra, not Iran, the Iran hostage crisis. Ronald Reagan was, for me, again, for reasons I couldn't possibly have articulated as a 12-year-old, was my great hero. I remember when I was in seventh grade gym class and the attempt on his life was made, the world sort of stopped for a few hours until we knew that he was all right. Of course, my parents, really super conservative evangelical Protestant folk. I grew up in a parish where the pastor was really politically minded, was always talking about, I don't know if some of you are old enough like me to remember some of the boycotts of certain television programs and things like that. Anyway, all that to say, I don't think I really thought about what is underneath that. What foundation should be laid for building political engagement as a mature Christian until I was well into adulthood? By the way, I never met anybody who was devoutly religious and also politically liberal until I was actually serving as a chaplain in the United States Air Force. And anyway, I won't bore you with all those stories either, but it's interesting, caused me to dig deep and to think a little bit, and that's what I want to share a little bit with you about today. And the title of the talk today is God a Republican or a Democrat? The implications of Christian faith on political party affiliation. What's got me thinking about this particularly in 2016 is probably what's very much on all of our minds as well if we pay any attention at all to what's going on. You can't turn on the television to a news station without seeing seemingly a Trump rally, or perhaps a little bit less frequently, something Hillary Clinton is saying or doing. I read constantly the polls. In fact, last night when I got home, I was looking. There was a poll that shows that if not a majority, a plurality, a large chunk of the public would like a third option, would rather not have to choose between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Well, the question that I want to ask, and I've got three questions today, and feel free to jump in if you've got something that you want to say. That's all the introduction. Let's get down to business here. First question is political party affiliation permissible for a Christian? I think my group yesterday, I wasn't clear. I think some people thought I was saying, is it a bad thing for Christians to vote? Well, of course not. You know, we've been talking all week about how we want to be engaged in the public square, in public life. But the question is very intentional. Is political party affiliation permissible for a Christian? Should I be known as being a greenie or a libertarian or a Democrat or a Republican? Is that something that's a good thing for a Christian? Let me talk a little bit more and see if you can see where I'm coming from here. By the way, I'm not going to tell you what the answer to any of my questions are today. And no, I don't endorse political candidates. I hope we can arrive at some conclusions together. The proper relationship of the Christian to the state is a question that has perplexed the faithful since at least New Testament times. The scriptures don't speak specifically, of course, about modern political parties, but there are some principles within the scriptures that are helpful for Christians in navigating our way through the business of partisan politics. All of the synoptic gospels record the exchange between the Herodians and the Pharisees and Jesus about paying taxes to Caesar. After I'd already developed this outline, I was pleased to see that Bishop Michael had treated that particular passage as well. Let me point out to you real quickly that when Luke talks about it in Luke 20, verses 19 through 26, he describes it not as Herodians and Pharisees, but as scribes and chief priests, but it seems to be the same episode. So St. Matthew's Gospel, the 22nd chapter, St. Mark's Gospel, the 12th, and St. Luke's Gospel, the 20th, all talk about this. And this interaction that you're probably very familiar with turns on the duties of citizenship and clearly has implications for the relationship of Christians to the state. Jesus, as you know, asked to see a coin and asked whose inscription it bears. And you all know whose inscription that coin bears, yes?
Yeah, Pizza Boss.
Right. The image on the coin comes the reply from the crowd, like you as well, is Caesar's. Jesus says, "Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Caesar made the coin and it bears the stamp of his image, so giving it back to him as tribute or tax is perfectly acceptable for a follower of Jesus Christ, according to Jesus himself. God, on the other hand, made human beings in his image and they bear his stamp. And so giving ourselves back to God in worship and service is our duty, according to Jesus. Notice that these two realms, the secular, the this worldly, and the eternal, the world that is without end, have their own unique claims upon us, and we are free to render to Caesar and God what is their due. Importantly, what we owe Caesar and God are not the same things, and they must not be confused. Caesar is not to be worshipped, only God. St. Paul says largely the same thing in his epistle to the Romans. This is, I'm quoting from chapter 13. "For the same reason you also pay taxes for the authorities or ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay all of them their dues, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due." In the early church, anything resembling political party affiliation was not terribly common because Christianity at that time was an illicit religion and it was officially persecuted from very early days. Furthermore, Christians were drawn largely from the working classes, not the landed gentry or the aristocracy who would have had time to engage in political topics. I'll just give you as a reference here, St. Paul's letter to the first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 1, verse 26, "For consider your call, brethren, not many of you were wise according to worldly standards, not many were powerful, not many were of noble birth." Later on, when Christianity was legalized and later still made the official religion of the Roman Empire, the relationship of Christianity to the state changed rather dramatically and quickly. Constantine's embrace of the Christian faith, and no, we're not going to debate whether that was genuine or not, meant that simply paying taxes and doing one's duty was no longer the norm for Christians. It went further, didn't it? Christians suddenly found themselves as active participants in shaping and making decisions within the empire. St. Augustine's just war theory makes very little sense in a world where Christianity is without voice and vote, so to speak, but it is very much to the point in an empire ruled by Christian emperors, however nominal their Christianity may have been. Certainly in the days of the Holy Roman Empire and the many Christian kingdoms of Europe and beyond, the idea that Christians were actively engaged in political life was perfectly acceptable. Christian men and women took part in the great debates of the age and took sides in the great disputes that shaped the world and its map. In the Magna Carta, signed by King John at Runnymede on 15 June 1215, in the year of our Lord, we see this political engagement of Christian men with the state reach a new high water mark. It is specifically as Christian men that the claimants make their claims in the Great Charter. And I've got a copy of it here if you'd like to look at it later. Of particular interest to us as Americans are the founding documents of our own nation. The Declaration of Independence is a work that locates the rights and privileges of free men in what the Declaration calls it divine endowments. All men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. They don't come from the state, they come from God. While the founders were not keen on political parties as such, in fact, George Washington, as you no doubt know, was specifically warned against what he called factions. While they weren't keen on political parties, it was Christian men and women who founded this nation and who founded our political parties. So perhaps we can begin to answer our first question by saying that it's at least theoretically possible to be a Christian and to be a proponent of a political party or at least a platform of policies. We must realize, of course, that not everyone will agree. I had a college classmate. I tried to encourage him to vote in my first election for my preferred candidate, who was Papa Bush. He was running against Mike Dukakis. I thought the choice was pretty clear for me as a young Christian college student. And I remember trying to give him a bumper sticker, a Bush Quail bumper sticker. And he recoiled like I was going to give him the plague or something. And specifically his response has always stuck with me. He said, "Oh, I don't get involved in politics. It's the devil's business." And I thought all that needs to happen in order for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Right, for us not to be engaged. And so At any rate, many religious sects and movements, have eschewed participation in the political process, especially among the pacifist traditions. As you know, partisan political participation is frowned upon, if not forbidden altogether, and that varies a little bit across movements and also across time. For the sake of making a hypothetical case for partisan political participation on the part of a Christian, you and me, could we imagine it being permissible at a minimum for a Christian to support, a platform of a party that sought to ensure, for example, the protection of all human life from conception to natural death, and that further sought to ensure that none of the nation's citizens was utterly destitute due to physical or mental disability or advanced age, and that further sought to ensure that our nation refused to become entangled in foreign wars, only permitting wars to defend against aggression to our own state? By the way, I'm not saying that's my platform. I'm just wondering if such a party platform could be supported in conscience by a committed Christian of Orthodox belief, be she a Reformed Episcopalian or a Roman Catholic or something else. And so I'll pause here for just a second to see what your thoughts are, see if you have objections or rebuttals up to this point. Right.
In the first place.
Right.
And that supporting and trying to further causes that exemplify Christian values is an obligation. Now, okay. The tough part is politics is so ball of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Well put.
They say this, but they mean that.
Yeah.
And here's this bill that's going to do all these things, but in order to get the bill that protects the handicapped and the
right.
You have to slip in and you have to approve abortion. So right. There isn't any black and white in politics. It's very, very, very hard to get just one straight answer out of anybody.
I don't disagree with that. Anybody else have some thoughts you'd like to share on this particular
point? Well, I think a platform, and I think that especially when we talk about voting,
yes.
In a place like a church like we're in right now,
mm-hmm.
often the talk is about platforms,
yes.
and not about action.
Right.
In my political experience, and maybe this isn't the same for yours, I'm not saying
okay.
this is how it is,
right.
Perceived things, is that the Republican and the Democratic parties say that they are about and that they will do very different things.
Sure.
And it's also been my experience that when it comes time for them to do these things that they say that they're going to do,
right.
They don't do them.
Right.
Either because they choose not to do them,
yeah.
or because they just can't.
Or they don't get punished for it.
Right.
Right.
There aren't really procedures in place for what I would consider to be rapid governmental policy changes.
Right.
And which is by design.
Yeah.
So
no doubt.
When President Bush, George W. Bush, mm-hmm. Approved the bailout of a company,
right.
I was saying, well, that is something that FDR would do.
Yeah, right.
And did.
Yes.
That is certainly contrary to the Republican platform.
Right.
Think that it's a matter of what you're going to say and what you're going to do.
Yep.
And in the gospel, where's what's better?
Right.
Somebody who says yes.
Yeah.
And then
does
not.
Right.
Somebody who says no and then
yep.
does.
Yep.
So that's been my perception.
Yeah, I think your perception is not only what mine is, I think it's what the perception of a large part of the American electorate is, left and right. I mean, if you look at the Bernie Sanders phenomenon and you look at the Donald Trump phenomenon, both of those seem to be driven by dissatisfaction with people on the grassroots level with their own parties and how they have made good So I'm not a leftist, but I know some leftists. I can see how they look at President Obama and think he's not gone far enough. I mean, if I really believe what Bernie Sanders claims to believe, I would think Obama's a disappointment. But I can also see if I really believed that we need to, to pick one topic sort of at random, that we need to tell the European nations to provide for their own defense, and that's been talked about forever. But when somebody like Trump steps forward and says, maybe this whole NATO thing is not worthwhile, that gets people's attention. Now, one of the things I'd say real quick, too, in response to that, and this is one of my own frustrations, I love my country, I serve my country in uniform, you know, I vote in every dog catcher election, I never miss a primary, I vote in all the school bond elections, all that stuff, I'm a very dedicated voter. But our process, number one, has two parties. It's, you know, which choose your poison, which one. I mean, that's almost always the case, Democrat, Republican. And you're sort of stuck with not only whatever platform they present to you, but also whatever candidate they put forward for you to choose from. And then the only way we can respond is by voting the bums out, as we always say. But that's a very difficult thing to do. The powers of incumbency are hugely advantage the person who's already in office over any primary challenger or whatever. Let me say as well, real quick, like one of the things that I've always been fascinated by is parliamentary democracy, which of course is not how our country's political system is designed. And that is, you know, if I'm a person who is going to buy into this platform that I've just suggested to you here, I might be in some countries a Christian Democrat or something. In favor of a generous welfare state, but committed to life, committed to pro-family policies. That option doesn't exist in America today, except for, I was thinking when you were talking about one thing, and that is the referendum process, especially in the state of California, has radically changed, for good and for ill, depending on what you're talking about at what point in history, radically changed the state of California's politics, because the people can just forget about what they're doing in Sacramento, and they can just vote Proposition, you know, 1322 or whatever into law. So anyway, other thoughts real quick before we move on? Yeah.
Well, in the two-party system that yes. we have, doesn't it force us to, you know, you have a platform, but it forces us to prioritize.
Yes.
And so, okay,
absolutely right.
My vision might be this, and well, it's number one with me, but it's number two or three with them.
Right.
And so you're going to,
right.
Whereas in the, like you said, parliamentary or referendum system,
right.
If you know your priorities are just your one and two are different, well, you're in a different party. And
yeah.
You know, you have to work together to a coalition.
Right. 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 And so, for instance, to take that thought just a little bit further, real quick, we have two parties in America, and one is solidly identified with the pro-life movement. I'm not saying every Republican elected to office is really pro-life, but they have to at least do lip service to that because it's in the party platform. Has been forever. The Democratic Party, very firmly committed to not life, anti-life, to pro-abortion, to furthering that whole movement. I saw just the other day there's a group of Democrats, and I don't know where they come from or what their bigger agenda is, but they're appealing to have a pro-life plank in the Democratic Party's platform. Of course, that's never going to happen. But it's interesting that even within the Democratic Party, there's a recognition that maybe we're too focused narrowly on one particular interest group or issue. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, there's it, especially for a lot of conservatives. Conservatives can tend to look at pro-life in a very binary way, mm-hmm. or at least pro-life or abortion legislation as a very binary
right.
thing.
Right.
And I sing in a choir that rehearses at a Unitarian church.
All right.
If you want to call it a church.
Okay. Yeah.
And a Unitarian Universalist assembly, I would call it. And there was a bumper sticker that I saw, and it said, "Vote choice, choose life." Which was something that usually bumper stickers don't really do anything except annoy or make you. Like, whenever I see people with the coexist bumper sticker,
right.
I was saying, okay, this person's going to let me front of them. You
know? Yes.
They have to.
Right.
So, but But this was a bumper sticker that actually took me by surprise, and I stopped to think about it for a long time.
Right.
I never really reached any particular
goal,
but it was thought-provoking.
It is. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's move on, if we could, to the second question that I want to ask, and I'm happy to stick around afterwards if you want to talk a little bit more. But I don't want to hold you hostage past our time to dismiss. The second question I want to ask is there a political party naturally more hospitable to people of Christian faith? If political party affiliation is permissible for a Christian, I think we are all in agreement that it's okay to register as a Republican or a Greenie or whatever you want to do and vote. By the way, it's a matter of conscience. I would never in a million years as a parish priest get up in the pulpit and tell my people how they ought to vote. Now, they know that I'm a very conservative person and they're very clear on what my position on the issues is, but I don't endorse candidates. Appropriate, I don't think. But if party affiliation is permissible for a Christian, should we choose sides? I've already alluded very briefly to having grown up in the South. I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Tennessee and Nashville, and I saw something amazing happen while I was growing up. When I was a boy, everyone in Tennessee was a Democrat. That's not quite true, but it seemed like it. Everybody who was elected to anything was definitely a Democrat, unless you were from East Tennessee. That was the part of the state that stayed with the Union during the Civil War, and those people were historically Republicans, and nobody trusted the East Tennessee folk. Anyway, from Nashville all the way to Memphis, the only way you were going to get elected to any office was if you had a D next to your name. But what happened with the arrival of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s was that changed, and it changed almost overnight, or so it seemed. One day I just sort of woke up and we had two senators that were both Republicans and the governor was a Republican and virtually every statewide office holder was a Republican. Of course, that happened all across the South. Some of the states were a little bit slower. I think Arkansas may have been the very last state to finally sort of flip, and no longer be blue but red, as they say. But if you were growing up, if you were in the Tennessee, for instance, in the 1970s and even into the early 80s, you could, in conscience, and I knew a lot of people who did, you could in conscience support Democrats, even for national office, because a lot of those people were solidly pro-life, a lot of those people were anti-communist, they were whatever, in fact, I was telling the group yesterday, I remember reading a story one time that I thought was fascinating. Back in the 1950s, I was not alive back then, I should say that, but when Eisenhower ran against Adlai Stevenson, I can't remember who these qualities were attributed to, but they said one was an incrementalist and the other was a gradualist. There wasn't really, in those days, a dime's bit of difference between the two national parties on the big questions. Everybody was anti-communist. Everybody was, of course, nobody was thinking about abortion on demand in the 1950s. Everybody was for a strong role for Christian faith in the public square, etc. Not so anymore. Of course, back in the day, the South was called the Solid South because it was solidly Democratic. It's still the Solid South, but now, of course, the parties have reversed. Nowadays, it's nearly impossible to get elected to any meaningful statewide office in Tennessee if you fail to have an R next to your name. The same's true for now, at least in Texas, as best I can discern. The party I live in, Parker County, usually there's not even a Democratic candidate fielded for most elections. The real race is the primary, because everybody's a Republican in Parker County. It's not quite true, but that's certainly what it seems like. Back to our question, though. Is there a political party naturally more hospitable to people of Christian faith? Before we jump to it, by the way, I posed this question to a parishioner of mine the other day, and he said, absolutely, God is a Republican. All thinking Christians must be Republicans. He's a big... No, not really. Yeah, he's a big Trump supporter. Good guy, but anyway, we have our differences of opinion about a few things. The answer to the question may reveal more about what sort of tribal identity we ascribe to than the issues at stake, in my opinion. If I'm wrong, I'll confess my sins. So, for instance, just to give you a few examples, for church-going ethnic Roman Catholics in the Northeast, the answer has been for many generations that the Democratic Party is a more hospitable place for Roman Catholics of Irish descent, for instance, to settle down. For church-going African Americans, the answer has for several generations been that the Democratic Party is more hospitable to black churchgoers. To white Christians from the South, especially non-Roman Catholics and non-Eastern Orthodox, the answer has been for nearly 40 years, by my estimation, the Republican Party is more hospitable to them and to their faith. Well, choosing sides seems to be what partisan politics is all about, right? It strikes me that winning and losing is the name of the game, not being right on the issues necessarily, not most of the time at least. Among Republicans, the cry goes up, how long? Republicans tired of losing, desire to win, even if that means doing so with candidates that may not represent the beliefs of the majority of the primary voters. By the way, I noticed this in a way this election cycle that I don't think I've ever really been struck with so strongly, that there's such a huge disconnect between what the people who actually trudge to the polls and push the button or pull the lever, or however you vote, what they say they believe and what's important to them, and what the party leadership, and again this is true in both major political parties, what they say is important, what their priorities are. Of course, the party leadership is scrambling to try to somehow reconnect with the angry voters. Okay. Okay, well, that's before my time, I'm proud to say. let me cut through a little bit of this for the sake of time. Again, I say I don't endorse candidates, I'm not going to do that here either, but what I do wonder and be interested in your opinion on, honestly, is whether the Democratic candidate or the Republican candidate for president this year represents your Christian beliefs in any meaningful way. Notice that I didn't ask whether one of them is closer than the other. Whether one of them is closer than the other, or whether you dislike one of them much less than you dislike the other. I wonder whether you're persuaded by arguments that I hear all the time that go something like, a non-vote for candidate X is really a vote for candidate Y. I must confess that my own thinking on the subject runs along a different line. It seems to me that the party should conform to the voter and not the other way around. In other words, I shouldn't be looking as a Christian for which party offends my Christian conviction and commitment least egregiously. I should instead be looking for a party or a platform or a candidate which reflects my beliefs most closely. As a matter of conscience, I don't see how I can approve that which I believe to be wrong simply because it isn't as horrible as what the other candidate stands for and promotes. Two wrongs, as Grandma always said, don't make a right. And I'd give you, by the way, as a scriptural sort of support for that, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 17, and also St. Paul's argument in his Roman epistle, chapter 6, should we sin that grace may abound? You know, God forbid, let it never be true of us. Of course, this whole question of which party might be more hospitable to Christian faith is complicated. I admit that. In general, I might be inclined to believe that one or the other of the two major parties is more in alignment with Christian principles. But the process of picking a presidential candidate has undergone a revolution in the last 100 years or so, ever since Teddy Roosevelt decided to oppose a sitting president, which was pretty phenomenal that he did that. His own hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft, he ends up opposing his renomination. Ever since then, political parties no longer present a party to the candidate as a representative of the party of the platform. Now we go to the polling place and we vote on that. But of course, you know, with open primaries, a lot of times the people voting in the Democratic Party primary, a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters were not Democrats. They were independents and whoever else. A lot of Donald Trump supporters, not necessarily Republicans, because anybody can vote in those things. Well, real quickly, to bring this point to a conclusion here, let me just state the obvious. 2016 is a strange year indeed. I've never seen anything like it in my life. If primary voters had been allowed to select the Democratic Party's nominee, it might very well be the case that Bernie Sanders would be the candidate and not Hillary Clinton. Republicans appear poised to nominate a candidate, and by the way, Bernie Sanders has not been a Democrat, you know, officially, really ever. Republicans appear poised to nominate a candidate who has until recently supported Democrats for election to Senate, President, et cetera, made very nice, generous donations to the Democratic Party quite a bit over the years. To probe a little further, let's say you're a Democrat historically and you supported Bernie Sanders because of his populist candidacy. You thought of him as kind of a modern-day William Jennings Bryan or something like that. Do you now find that the Democratic Party is your home when it's set to nominate someone who has made millions by being, well, anything but a William Jennings Bryan? Alternatively, if you are a Republican and you've historically been motivated to go to the polls by the promises, and this touches on the point that was made by a couple of you earlier, by the promises of the Republican Party to promote a culture of life and to defend the institution of marriage, do you now make your home in the Republican Party as they prepare to nominate a candidate who, as of today at least, continues to defend his defense of Planned Parenthood, hedging his bets a little bit about the abortion stuff, but saying repeatedly that the nation's largest abortion provider does a lot of good work for women, and who is himself a serial adulterer by his own testimony and married to wife number three. And so this is the end of this paragraph in question. I'm genuinely interested to hear what your thoughts are on this. What did you call it a while ago? Bollocks up? Yes.
Well, I just say that the reason that we have the two-party system
is
a relatively recent thing. It came about, especially in terms of the way that presidential candidates are chosen by their parties.
Right.
And that happened as a result of the Russian Revolution. They didn't want to see a third party coming in and very quickly wreaking havoc on all that they've created, and so they instituted some changes to the Democratic Party with those superdelegates that we've been hearing about. Yeah. Nobody really actually knows where they come from or what they do.
The deck is definitely stacked against a third party candidate's hard to get on the ballot in all 50 states, et cetera. Yeah.
I'll just go back at that.
Yeah, yeah.
I am the person. It's me. The brother
who wrote
twice.
Okay. I have a brother-in-law that did the same thing. Yeah.
I'm trying to do that with Perot, so that's, I don't know.
Excellent. Well, the point that you make is a good one. There's nothing in our Constitution that says that we have to have two parties and two parties only, but people in power are able to manipulate the way that it works, and everything does tend to funnel in. And in a way, it works pretty well. Remember my opening illustration about the Dallas Cowboys? That'd be a much more confused situation in the 1979 Super Bowl if it had been the Dallas Cowboys against the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Green Bay Packers, right? Because that's not how games of football are played. It's so easy for us to have that, as is so commonly, you know, that binary choice, candidate A, candidate B.
But when they're both failing to fulfill any objective that you might have, then what do you do?
Well, that's what the third question is all about. And by the way, all of this, if you haven't discerned already, all of this really comes out of my own personal sort of struggle to make sense of what seems like a completely insane situation. And as a parish priest, when the faithful come to me and want my opinion and they want me to sort of adjudicate their voting preference or whatever, I think that's part of it. Yeah. But I'm also a father of four, well, they're not children anymore, they're almost all grown, but I'm the father of four offspring, and a very politically aware household. My 18-year-old's home from college for the summer, and my 15-year-old, I came home last night and I had to have about a 30-minute interview with both of them while I was trying to watch the Rangers game and relax a little bit about politics. They're so engaged, my 18-year-old especially, because this is going to be his first general election. My 15-year-old, just because he's super right-wing and is super afraid that we're headed for a train wreck in the fall. So these things all have consequences, and this is where we're going, this third and final question. Does your Christian faith determine your political party affiliation? Ted said to the group yesterday, I was a member of the Teamsters Union for 3 years while I worked at UPS because I was going to seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. It's a great way for me to provide for my family. It was a closed shop. If you wanted to work there, you had to join the Teamsters, period, end of story. Well, the Teamsters were constantly telling me how to vote and what my political priorities should be, and they were taking my union dues and giving them to candidates that I wouldn't have supported in a million years. But did I ever walk into the polling place when I was a Teamsters member? By the way, I'm a life member, actually. I've got a card to prove it. When I was working for UPS and I was actively paying dues, did I ever let that influence in the least bit how I voted? No. But a lot of guys I worked with absolutely, and gals for that matter, absolutely did.
Was it that they let themselves in?
I think that's back to the question about the pilot thing. Right. So is my party affiliation adiaphora? Is it a matter indifferent? A lot of people seem to think that's the case. Or is it essentially part of who I am as a Christian? I suppose what I'm at most pains to try to communicate to you today is that same thing I try to communicate to my parish and to my family. Actions have consequences, and as Christians, we should not be reflexively or uncritically supportive of anything simply because that's what our tribe does. I think I could give you lots of examples, but I'd go back again for just a second. I've had some wonderfully enlightening conversations with some Roman Catholic friends who are reflexively and uncritically democratic in their voting patterns. And I say, how can you be a every Sunday communicant at your Roman Catholic parish where, you know, the official teaching of your church says the following things, all of which are specifically being not just eroded, but attacked and annihilated by the candidate that you just went and voted for? How does that work? A lot of times we check out, we let other people do our thinking for us, or I want to suggest to you, a lot of people think of it very easily compartmentalized in our lives, right? What I do at Mass on Sunday is one thing. What I do at the job is another thing. What I do in the polling place is another thing. I'm going to suggest something to you that we all know, but a lot of times we fail to live it. When I drive back to Fort Worth today, excuse me, on the President George Bush Turnpike, I'm driving as a believer, as a disciple of Jesus Christ. That has implications. My Christian faith has implications for how I play golf. Badly, by the way. I play golf very badly, and not often, thankfully. But when I go to the polling place, do I take off Christ and hang Him up, as it were, on the coat rack, go in there, vote on my economic interest or whatever, and then come back and put on Christ as I leave the elementary school? Or do I take Jesus into the polling place with me? I would suggest to you, and I've said this to some people and they thought I was moralizing, I think that's what they accused me of, everything we do as a Christian in our life, we do coram Deo, before the face of God. There's an aspect of every relationship we have, every job that we do, every word we speak, every thought we think, it all is reflective of who we claim to be, who we profess to be as Christians. And so what I'm talking about real shorthand here is there's a relationship between orthodoxy, right belief, and orthopraxy, right behavior. And a lot of times we get those things separate and compartmentalized in our lives. And so again, let me conclude and then I'll have time for questions and comments. Again, I'm not here to endorse a candidate, but I do want to endorse the idea that who you are in Christ is not something that you can check at the classroom door in order to succeed in academia. It's not something you can check at the door to the polling place. What you and I approve and disapprove, what you and I vote for or against, is a profoundly spiritual activity with serious implications. So my question as I conclude here is, might we be able to agree that one's Christian faith is... Let me do a little editing on the fly here. Might we be able to agree that one's Christian faith should be determinative in giving or withholding one's approval of a political party or its platforms or its candidates? And so I'll end up by giving a few minutes for your questions and comments and rebuttals and whatnot. Yes, sir.
Well, I'm wondering, I mean, when you talk about putting on Christ everywhere, and
right,
specifically including when you go into the polling booths,
right,
I wonder if Jesus were given the opportunity, would he have even voted? Because very often,
that's a great question.
When the leaders, the Pharisees, would approach him about an issue of mm-hmm. the state, or even
right.
an issue of the law that was even greater than the state, mm-hmm. often he transcended it. So it is a question we're pondering, and I'm not going to try to answer it,
yeah.
whether or not Jesus would have. have actually voted.
Right. What would Jesus do with regard to voting? Yeah.
And, but also, there is the idea behind voting for a for leadership is either upholding a status quo or changing for the better the status quo. I don't think it really can be boiled down to anything else. And
no, I agree. Yeah.
So I would say that if the entire goal is to either uphold the status quo or to change it for the better, I would suggest that voting is not nearly the most efficient way to do any of those things.
Right. No, I want to agree with you. My particular chosen topic is voting, but absolutely, and what I say to my children and what I say to my parishioners is the way that we change the culture is by being engaged, you know, running for school board. It's you know, being involved in your Rotary Club in your area. It's being known to your neighbors. It's lots of other things. Voting is an important part, but I think you're absolutely right. Now, when I was growing up, I didn't ever hear anything in my home about politics. I absorbed it all by osmosis. My dad was of the mindset that's just something you didn't talk about, right?
And so,
and it's pretty much. Although God, we talked about God a lot. We were devoutly religious, but then I came of age during a period of great activism. It was kind of a new thing on the political scene as a young kid when Jerry Falwell and his Moral Majority, you know, came out and started endorsing candidates, and suddenly you had all these evangelical Protestants, especially in my part of the world, over in the southeast part of the country, suddenly getting active and being open and donating money and endorsing candidates and all that sort of stuff. That hadn't really been all that common before. And I think one of the things that, and this is just my anxiety, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. I think as a result of a lot of that, the church, specifically traditional conservative church going folk, be they Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Protestant, whatever, we've just sort of been co-opted by the Republican Party, where I think now the Republican Party largely views people like me as being just as dependable as the Democratic Party views African-American religious people. We don't even have to worry about their vote. It's solid. Therefore, we can ignore their interest and concern. Somebody else had a comment, I thought. Yep.
Well, being kind of one of those people, like you,
yeah,
votes for it in every election.
Oh, yeah.
Kate was raised that way. Primary, my father kind of forgot that it was being held, and the voting judge called up and asked him. Okay.
Oh, no.
But, you know, sitting here today, you know, in a quandary, but I think you're right. You know, voting is a one time, you know, if you want to change, it's right for office. But
right.
Otherwise, you work in the,
yep,
that's where the change comes.
Right. Yeah, and but that's not the way elections are run, and that's not the way that the average person seems to think anymore. I have people in my sphere of influence who, honest to goodness, are talking about this election like if the wrong choice is made, it's, you know, it's Armageddon, it's the end of the world. But then I thought, well, wait a second, we said that in 1992 and 1996 and 2008 and 2012, and things have gotten progressively worse from my perspective, but the end hasn't quite come yet. And so, yeah, maybe there's a little overemphasis on it. Let me say this real quick because I know it's time to go. The answer to the question, is God a Republican or a Democrat, is no. God, of course, is beyond human history. He's outside of human history. He's above human history. It's not that God... What's that? That's right. It's not that God doesn't care. Not that God doesn't care, but I think what, if I could leave you with anything, is voting the most important thing you can do in the public square? No. Is it isn't important? Should you vote in every election? I think absolutely, as a Christian, you should. Somebody said it yesterday, I believe, and we were talking about it at our dinner table last night. Know that the forces of secularism and anti-religion or irreligion in our culture are ascendant. They've got the wind at their backs. They're super well organized, and they never rest. They never rest. They'll keep pushing. And if we think that we can just sort of sit back and I think this is where I was for a long time. I couldn't imagine a world in which a mandate would come down from the Department of Justice that people could pick based on how they were feeling that day which restroom to use. I'm just beginning to wake up to the reality of the world that we really live in versus the way, and this is a problem getting old, right? I still remember the world as it was and want to believe somehow that America hasn't changed that much, and yet it has because the leadership has changed that much. But anyway, we can talk about this endlessly. I'll let you go if you need to go.